16th, 2015. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present: Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Stedman, Senator Coghill, and myself, Senator Giesel. So welcome. Senator Machicki is engaged in other state business, so he won't be joining us today, and Senator Wadakowski is possibly going to show up later. Thank you to Ann and Jonathan for helping us out today, recording the minutes and managing the audio, and special thanks to Ike, my committee aide, who has done a significant amount of work on this today. Today we're going to start out by taking up House Bill 137, and then after that we will have a presentation from Analytica on the gas pipeline. So, welcome to the bill sponsor, Representative Tallarico, and his committee aide, Joshua Banks. Welcome. Representative Tallarico, if you would present your bill to us, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and committee members. For the record, my name is Dave Tallarico, and I represent District 6. And I will try and make this reasonably brief for you. I know you've got a very busy schedule. So House Bill 137 is really a response from a lot of individuals, hunters, fishermen, outdoorsmen, some outdoorsmen groups in the Department of Fish and Game, with the concern about our license and tag fees and the potential of actually raising those fees to generate some revenue. There's currently a deficiency between the cost associated with our management needs and the revenue that's brought in by the license and tag fees. So the biggest change that House Bill 37 makes is we would raise resident and non-resident fishing, trapping, and combination licenses to help deal with the deficiency. The most significant change that we have in any of the fees are the non-resident fees, and that would be the big game tags. Those are really the most significant changes, in my estimation, that are contained in the bill. HB 137 also changes the eligibility requirements for low-income licenses, and rather than having a number inserted into statute, it actually switches over to the poverty level, the federal poverty level that's set and changes on a routine basis. Our current number is $8,200, which I really can't tell you when that was set, when that was determined to be the poverty level. I certainly don't think that's a recent number. It's been a while since that's been there. Another thing that the bill has gone through several iterations, I will say, and has had some changes in it as it's proceeded. Within the bill now, there's a voluntary fish and game conservation decal that would be available to anyone that a person who potentially maybe doesn't consume the resource would be able to purchase, although I think a lot of people that actually are hunters and fishermen may also purchase the decal to continue to provide more funding into wildlife conservation and into our fisheries. The current fishing surcharge that's in there, this was a change that happened along the way, will be combined with the fishing license fee once the hatchery bonds are paid. And there wouldn't be an increase in the fishing license, but that $9 that's in there right now would remain with the current fee. And that was added in House Finance Committee as they heard the bill. The other changes to the bill, we would raise the eligibility for the hunting and fishing and trapping license exemption from age 60 to 62, and it would require that would be renewed every 3 years. What we have heard from some people in particular areas is a lot of people have been issued a lifetime license, and there's concern that some of those folks aren't Alaska residents anymore, but still come back to Alaska and utilize their lifetime license. So that was a concern that was also addressed in one of the committees. And a big one, and one that I'm fond of, the age required for residents to obtain an actual free license right now is you have to be under 16 years old. And my personal choice was to move that to 18. So our 16 and 17-year-olds, still potentially high school students or maybe not out in the adult workforce, would still be able to enjoy the hunting and fishing and acquire the free license. Madam Chair, it's been over 17 years since any of the non-resident fees have been raised, and 24 years since our resident fees have been raised. I think HB 137 for me is all about opportunity and the ability for us to ensure that as Alaskans and Alaska residents in particular have those opportunities that are still out in front of them, to enjoy the incredible hunting and fishing opportunities that we have. Madam Chair, I will leave it at that, and we can answer any questions.
Very good. You know, what this bill represents to me is an effort on the part of ADFMG to be more self-supporting. And, of course, in these fiscal times, that's something we're all pretty interested in seeing state government do. Just a few days ago, we had a bill from the Park Division of Natural Resources, again, looking at how to become more self-supporting since parks are reducing funding for them. So I appreciate this bill very much. Committee members with questions for the bill sponsor. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have several. I'd like them to walk through the bill and talk about the justification of the changes. I mean, they seem to be significant, 50 to 100%, third, and then I'd like to have a little more explanation, if I could, Madam Chairman, on the bonded indebtedness of the hatcheries, the embedded price increases we've had in our sport fishing license to pay for those two hatcheries, one in Fairbanks and one in Anchorage, we did a few years ago. And those of us that were here at the time were under the impression that those fees were going to go away at the end. And this bill apparently reaches forward in time and escalates or removes the ability for those bond revenue fees to go away, and seems a little far-reaching to me, but I'd like a little more in-depth than a 30,000-foot view on the policy of the significance.
Senator Stedman, just for clarification and for everyone, my intention today is to hear an overview of the bill. We have several people signed up already online. Let's see, it looks like four right now signed up to testify on it. They've made an effort to get to their LIOs. We've got some people in the room that want to testify, but we also have a second topic we're going to be taking up. So by 4:15, we're going to stop hearing this bill and set it aside. Just FYI. Senator Stoltz.
Madam Chair, just in that spirit, if it's going to come up again, I would like Department of Law to address the committee at the appropriate time just to talk about the Carlson issues and the disparate views, just so we know fully on the record that issue. It may have been discussed in previous issues, but that's
it. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Stoltz. We will not exhaustively hear the bill today. We will have other opportunity during interim probably as well as certainly in 2016. Thank you. So, yes.
For the record, Joshua Banks, staff to represent Tallarico. In your packet, we provided a legal opinion from Legislative Legal looking at the Carlson cases. And according to that opinion, the Carlson cases do not apply to this bill. They apply to commercial fishing. This bill solely deals with recreational hunting and fishing.
Thank you, Mr. Banks. Representative Tallarico, you were posed some questions by Senator Stedman. Would you like to address them or have your committee aide do that?
Madam Chair, if you would like, Mr. Banks maybe could rapidly go through sectional analysis.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Joshua Banks, staff representative Tallarico. And I can briefly go through the section analysis. Section 1 was amends a section to repeal authorization for money from the Fish and Game Fund to pay for hatchery bonds. Section 2 is raising the resident license requirement age to 18 and the exemption age to 62. Section 3 raises the resident sport fishing license from $15 to $20. And the fee for residents who are buying from 25 cents to 50 cents. Section 4 is a section dealing with the sport fishing surcharge and combining that with the resident sport fish license. Section 5 raises the hunting license from $25 to $30. 6 is dealing with the hunting and trapping combination license from 39 to 45. Section 7 is just the trapping license from $15 to $20. Section 8 is dealing with the hunting and fishing combo license, raising that $6 from $39 to $45. Section 9 amends Section 8 of this bill by combining the $9 surcharge into the resident hunting and fishing license. Section 10 makes a few amendments, raising the hunting, trapping, and fishing combo license from $53 to $60. It also changes the low-income license eligibility so that a person is only eligible for the low-income license if they meet the the poverty level requirement. And as the representative mentioned, we've taken out a dollar limit and we've just linked it to the federal poverty level, whatever the family size is. Section 11 amends Section 10 of this bill by, again, adding the $9 surcharge into the fishing, trapping, hunting combo fee. Section 12 amends the non-resident sport fishing license. 14-day license is being raised from $50 to $60. 7-day license from $30 to $40. 3-day license raised from $20 to $30, and the 1-day license from $10 to $15. Section 13, again, this adds the $9 surcharge into the non-resident sport fishing license fees. Section 14 raises the annual non-resident sport fishing license from $100 to $150. Section 15, again, adds the $9 surcharge into the annual non-resident fishing license. Section 16 raises the non-resident hunting license from $85 to $130. Section 17 increases the non-resident hunting and trapping combination license from $250 to $350. Section 18 increases a number of the non-resident big game tag fees. For black bear, it will now be $600 from $225. Brown or grizzly bear from $500 to $1,200, bison $450 to $900, caribou $325 to $650, deer $150 to $275, elk and goat will now be $575, moose is increased from $400 to $800, sheep $425 to $850, wolverine $175 to $325, and muskox $1,100 to $2,200. Section 19 makes multiple amendments. It creates conforming amendments to the raising of age for eligibility for a permanent license from 60 to 62 and the age that you have to get a license from 16 to 18. And it also raises the waterfowl conservation tag from $5 to $10. Section 20 increases the small game hunting license from $20 to $30. The non-resident alien hunting license in Section 21 is raised from $300 to $600. Section 22 amends the non-resident alien big game tag fees, and all of these are doubled. Black bear will be $600, brown grizzly bear and bison will be $1,300 now. Caribou, $850, deer, $400. Elk and goat will now be $800. Moose, $1,000. Muskox, $3,000. Sheep, $1,100, wolverine, $500. Section 23 raises the resident king salmon tag from $10 to $15, and this also makes conforming amendments to the blind fee, license fee increase, and the exemption age to 62 and the license requirement age to 18. And 24 raises all 6 non-resident king salmon tag fees. The 1 day will now be $15, 3 day is from $20 to $30, 7 day from $30 to $45, 14-day tag from $50 to $75, the annual tag from $100 to $150, and the annual non-resident military tag from $20 to $30. Section 25 is where we have the new fish and game conservation decal. That'll be $20, it'll be voluntary, and there was intent language put in this section to say that the legislature may appropriate these funds to fish and wildlife conservation programs. Section 26 raises the required age to have a sport fishing hunting and trapping license from 16 to 18. And the provision in this section regarding non-residents are not amended. And this section also amends the age that a resident can get a free hunting, fishing, and trapping license from 60 to 62. It also creates a requirement that those eligible for this license will have to renew it every 3 years, starting in 2019. Sections 27 through 31 make conforming amendments to raising the eligibility age from 60 to 62. And sections 28 and 29 make it so that a resident is allowed to hunt or fish on behalf of a person with a developmental disability. Section 32 deals with the number of repealed statutes regarding the fish hatchery and the surcharge. Section 33 creates transition language for those that are currently eligible for the free hunting fishing license over 6 years will continue to be eligible. Section 34 requires the Commissioner of Fish and Game to notify the reviser of statutes when all costs associated with the fish hatchery bonds under AS 3715-765 through 799 are paid and all obligations are fully met. Section 35 creates a conditional effect for that, so that sections 1, 4, 9, 11, 13, 15, and 32 of this bill will not be in effect until the reviser of statutes is notified under Section 34. And Section 36 adds uncodified language stating that Sections 1, 4, 9, 11, 13, 15, and 32 will be in effect January 1st of the calendar year following the notice in Section 34. And finally, Section 37 creates an effective date for the rest of the bill, which is January 1st, 2016.
Thank you very much, Mr. Banks. Good. So, further questions. We'll take a few more questions, and I'm going to go to public testimony. Senator Stedman, and before that, I want to mention that Senator Wilikowski has joined the committee. Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Just, you know, if we're going to, which I think is a good idea, Madam Chairman, to hold this bill and work on over an interim and into next January because of the magnitude of it, but I think we should have a review of the Carlson case. I think most of us recognize it's a commercial issue, but there is concern of any tie-ins with sport and an impact that may or may not come back. So I agree with Senator Stoltz. We should have the Department of Law in front of us for some discussion on that. I'd also like to have a review of the hatcheries, the history of them, and the status of them. One of the other issues we have here is the challenges that Senator Stoltz has in his district with sport fish, to see if we can't, as senators outside that area, come up with a better feel for, you know, what he's struggling with in his area, to try to help him get some solutions there, part of which I think is geared into that hatchery, which then both those items would tie in to components of this bill. And then we have the fee structure discussion within Fish and Game, and how Fish and Game should be restructured or changes in GF requests in their budgets process, Madam Chairman. If I can make those suggestions and then just let the initial rollout of the bill take place today.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Further comments or questions from committee members?
Thank you.
Senator Stoltz.
I'm going to defer all questions in deference to the public testimony. I just want to let you know I have to leave at 4 o'clock for a meeting downstairs, and hopefully I'll be back when the meeting's over.
All right, great. So, thank you. Why don't we go to public testimony? Some folks have signed up online, so I'm just going to take it as they appear here on my list. I've got Dick Rohr in the Kodiak LIO. Mr. Rohr, can you hear us? And if so, please put yourself on the record as well as your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dick Rohr here, and I'll pass and just listen today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Then we go to the off-net. Richard Bishop is on the off-net. Mr. Bishop, be sure to unmute yourself.
Richard Bishop, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Richard Bishop. I live in Gulfstream Valley in the Fairbanks, North Side Borough. I really appreciate being able to just call in to testify on HB 137. My background is I'm a retired game biologist and a traditional hunter, fisher, trapper, and an advocate for sound fishing game management and opportunity for all Alaskans to take advantage of these resources of fish and game. I do support HB 137. It was timely to review and update fishing, hunting, and trapping license and tag fee costs. I really appreciate Representative Tallarico initiating this job, knowing that there's a lot of strong opinions whenever you bring up fishing game issues, so it's always challenging. HB 137 is thoroughly cussed and discussed as it moves through the House. There's plenty of public and legislative comments, pro, con, and for alternate approaches. The result is a sound bill. It provides a needed boost in funding to maintain and improve management of sportfish and wildlife resource programs, and those programs to benefit all Alaskans as well as all the visitors. It also provides the means to capture more of the available federal aid to fish and wildlife restoration dollars, especially in wildlife, which has increased nationally, come from taxes on fishers, hunters, and trappers nationwide. And currently, as I understand it, the fish and game fund is not adequately endowed to take advantage of the considerable increase in Bittman Robertson federal restoration dollars. So this would help do that, as well as continue to help support important programs such as intensive game management, endangered species act issues, and public education where federal aid dollars can't be used. And also it provides for offsetting some of the potential losses of state general funds due to the current budget crunch. Fishers, hunters, and trappers have willingly paid to support sound fishing game management for decades, and we've come together around here in support of HB 137 to help pay for sound state fish and game management. I certainly urge the Senate Resources Committee to pass this bill and forward it. I would really like to see it pass this legislative session so that the resources available would be available to maintain the programs that help provide those opportunities which Representative Tallarico referred to in his introductory remarks. Without increases in funds and a delay in the implementation of these changes, some of those programs may be delayed or suspended or something, and that would be unfortunate. It would be a disadvantage to the general outdoor user public among Alaskans. Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Bishop. Next, we're going to the Fairbanks LRO, to Al Barrett. I'm going to ask testifiers to please limit your testimony to 3 minutes. Mr. Barrett, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Al Barrett, and I'm going to reserve my right to comment. I look forward to working with the committee and the committee members on this bill and to make it a really good bill over the interim. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Let's see, then the off-net, we have George Pierce. Mr. Pierce, welcome.
Thank you, ma'am, for taking my testimony. I'm George Pierce. I'm representing myself from Kosilov, Alaska. Parts of this bill I approve on, some parts I do not. First of all, no to a sockeye stance. That's kind of ridiculous in my opinion. The people own those resources. We should not be taxing the people that we raising the fees on these resources for the people. The personal use fishery is to be a subsistence fishery. We are entitled to this fish and game first. So I feel that you need to make some amendments. And the first amendment I wish somebody would make is to raise the hunting and fishing fees on guide services. The guide services take the non-residents out, and they make tons of money on these folks, so there's no reason why you shouldn't amend this to add guides of hunting and fishing on there. And while you're doing a review of this, and I sure hope you don't rush this through, do a review on the guide fees, how much they really do pay. And I'd like to point out that we don't need this fast track through here, and over 90% of your testimony that has come is from guides that want to take and raise the fees for the residents that own this resources, but they don't want to raise their fees. I agree with raising the fees on the non-residents, 100%. So do that and let the residents that own these resources not be raised. Thank you very much, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Pierce. Next person in the off-net is Tom Bookover. Mr. Bookover, let's see, it looks like you're here, you're from Fish and Game, and you're here for questions only. Did you want to add any comments at this time?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Bookover, Fish and Game. I don't have any comment. I am available for questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for being online. So next I'll come into the room. There's several folks signed up to testify. Eddie Grasser from Palmer is here. After Mr. Grasser, it looks like Gary Stevens will be next. Welcome, Mr. Grasser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the committee's edification, Gary Stevens from the Alaska Outdoor Council is with me. We're testifying together to emphasize the impact that this issue has on our combined groups. ALC is the largest umbrella sportsman's group in the state, and SCI is one of the largest membership groups in the state. Some of you have been to our annual banquet, where over 1,500 people attend in Anchorage, and we raise significant dollars for conservation. One of the things about the sportsman's community, I'm going to give a little history of this, and Mr. Stevens will add some direct comments to the bill. In America, over 100 years ago, people like Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, George Bird Grinnell got together and initiated a process that was to become known as the North American Model for Wildlife Conservation. It is undoubtedly the most successful conservation structure that's ever been devised by mankind. Took things like wild turkey, white-tailed deer, Rocky Mountain elk, from virtually being on the verge of extinction, and today, those populations are thriving. In fact, some biologists claim that white-tailed deer populations are either at or above levels from when Columbus made landfall in America. So it's a great model, and one of the central ingredients of that model is sportsmen, going back for over 100 years, have agreed to pay for it. And that's what we're asking to do here. We're coming to you saying we would like to see these license increases, because we know that in order for us to go hunting and fishing, somebody has to manage those resources and do it in a way so we know what the harvestable surplus is. Without adequate funding, the department can't do that. And those people that think that they're going to be able to go hunting and fishing anyway, even if they don't pay, the state will have to probably fall back on what's known as the precautionary rule and not allow this expanded seasons and harvest limits that we enjoy right now because of programs like intensive management. So we would like to thank Representative Tallarico for introducing this legislation. All through this process, we have worked with the sponsor and other members of the legislature in an attempt to make sure that those things that we thought were vital to the future of wildlife and fisheries management in the state were put into the bill. There's a couple items that Mr. Stevens will address in his comments. But I brought up our banquet. Many of you may or may not know, but recently a wood bison herd was transported out to Shagalook in a restoration project. My organization, Supply Club International, put up enough money to match sportsman's dollars from the Pittman-Robertson Act to pay for that whole trip, more or less. There was some donated time from Linden, I think. You'd have to ask Director Dale that, or somebody else from the department. But we put up a large amount of money to make that happen. That's something that we're willing to do. We not only are willing to pay for license and tag increases, We're willing to put money that we raise personally into projects that helps wildlife conservation. We do that here in Alaska, and we do it all over the world. And almost all the sportsmen's groups I know of do that. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation in Alaska is responsible for several major habitat purchases. Ducks Unlimited has done that. Rough Grouse Society does habitat work throughout South Central Alaska. So we're talking about an organization of men and women that have spent their lives both avidly pursuing outdoor activities and hunting and fishing, but are willing to pay for it. And at this time, we look forward to working with you in the interim. We feel there are some things in the bill that need to be increased in order for us to actually meet and match the federal funds that are available. And with that, I'll turn this over to Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Stevens. I live in Chugiak, and I am here representing the Alaska Outdoor Council. Thank you for the opportunity. Primarily, I just want to talk about intensive management and that surcharge that's not currently in the bill. AOC is grateful for legislators and past board members of the Board of Game, for their support in funding this intensive management programs during times of financial prosperity here in the state of Alaska. Now that that's not the case anymore, AOC's membership is willing to step up and help pay for the continued funding of these IM programs that benefit all Alaskan hunters. After all, hunters are taking a public resource for our personal use, and it only makes sense that we would help fund the department to ensure that the IM programs, which include predator-prey management, habitat improvement, survey and inventory assessments, that those programs continue when the state is lacking the necessary funding. It's critical to the future of the Department of Fish and Game and to the management of our renewable resources. AOC is a member club. We have about 48 different club members in the state. We represent about 10,000 people. At our annual meeting down here in Juneau in February, we had 21 different clubs represented. We went through this bill and came to an agreement, basically, among the coalition of people from all walks of life. And this is a very, very important bill. The $10 IM surcharge that's not part of the bill currently, it's got a three-year sunset, and it's got legislative oversight. And it's critical to taking advantage of those PR funds that are going to be absolutely necessary for reasonable management of our resources. In the end, I guess at this point, we don't support the bill as written, but we look forward to working with you in the interim, and hopefully we can get this pushed out in January. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Grasser and Mr. Stevens. Any questions, committee members? All right, seeing none, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next person up for signed up here is Ron Somerville. Mr. Somerville. And after he speaks, Mr. Thor Stacey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ron Somerville. I live here in Juneau, and I brought Thor up here to give me some backing, moral support.
Sounds good.
And I appreciate the opportunity to testify for the committee and the Territorial Sportsmen, which is the group I belong to here in Juneau, and I'm also from Discovery here. I'm also a member of the Outdoor Council. But we got interested in this license increase issue mainly because I was here when Governor Hickel came into the scene, and he asked our department to take a 5% decrease the first year, and I asked how many did he want in the 4 years, and he said 5% per year. And I'm saying this only because that meant a 20% reduction in the budget, general fund monies in the budget. Well, we had some general fund monies in both sport fish and wildlife, and they disappeared. I mean, you can understand the pressures inside the department to maintain commercial fisheries weirs or counting towers, all the various things that general fund monies go for in the Department of Fish and Game rise to a higher, in the minds of some people, a higher value. And also from the legislative standpoint, you've already seen in the budget this year, proposed for this coming budget, about $3 to $4 million out of sport fish and wildlife out of general fund monies. I don't think any of us think that that won't continue next year and the year after. It'll disappear. And that's why we're here. I talked my organization into starting the process of looking at how we could could convince the legislature to tax us more, if you will, allow us to pay more fees to carry on these programs. We had a reason for that. What we tried to do was develop a systematic process to come up with a proposal that kind of made sense, was consistent. And we looked at the license fee increase since 1993. There's been changes. It's already been recognized, the surcharge for the hatcheries and things like that. But general license increases, it's been 22 years since we've had that. And there's nothing to prevent us from thinking that, with no disrespect to the legislature, we may live 22 more years before we see a license increase again. So we were looking at increasing the licenses enough to not only meet the present demand, but giving us a little fluff, if you will, to catch any additional programs that we want to fund in the future. It takes 63% increase in all those licenses to bring us up just the inflation level. And working with Fish and Game, all the organizations involved in this, and there's, as you've already been told, 30-some organizations have been involved in developing a compromise. What we've eventually came up with, to make a long story short, is we felt that the residents should take an 80% increase, non-residents and tag fees 100% increase, and 80% or 50% depending on their general licenses. And the reason for that was to have something that was consistent, not just we could sit here in every committee and argue over each one of those license fees. And I think Representative Tallarico, he chose also to take approach of a consistent percentage increase as much as he could. That's changed since he started, but that was the approach. There's a couple things I want to stress, and Madam Chair, if I can, I have just a map and a graph I would like, if the staff could. I've already asked, and they said to ask you if I could present this. I'll make it go quicker, picture being
worth that's fine. Words. We are on the second three-minute segment here, so.
Okay,
yes. I'm judicious, please.
I'm just about
sure.
One of those is a graph showing the Fish and Game Fund and the Pittman-Robertson monies, and you'll show a $10 million separation between the amount of Pittman-Robertson money, the federal monies available, and how much we've been able to obligate. So that's standing there. It has to be, in a two-year period, has to be obligated or else it reverts back to the federal government. We're way behind the power curve right now on matching federal monies. I'll let that go with that, but that graphic clearly shows it. The other is a map showing where the predator control programs under the IM programs, required, by the way, by the legislature in statute, those are the programs that are in existence. And I asked the House Finance Committee, and I'll ask the same thing here, if we don't get a license increase this year, I'd like you to tell me which one of those programs you'd like to see disappear, and in what order, because the only money that can be used to match those programs is either Fish and Game Fund money or general fund money, and that's a dilemma. Yes, I'm asking you to pass a bill this year, because if we don't, we're going to lose some of those programs. Which ones? That's up to Fish and Game and the board. But anyway, that's my pitch, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Somerville. Mr. Stacey.
Madam Chair, thanks for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Thor Stacey, and I'm here representing the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and I'll be very brief. I want to hit on four main points. One is the support of the hunting guide industry for this. The second is the aspects of how this relates to federal overreach and oversight. The third is a detail that came out of House Finance, the increases to black bear and brown bear tag fees. And fourth, I can sum up in, you know, freedom to manage Alaska's wildlife, one of the constitutionally defined resources that we shall conserve and manage on a sustained yield basis. We would like that freedom from oil revenue, meaning freedom from necessary general fund appropriations. So going to industry support, 90% of Alaska's hunting guides are Alaska residents, but we rely on non-resident clients to come here. Given that relationship between resident guides and resident industry and the reliance on non-resident hunters, it takes a stiff upper lip to support a fee increase on non-resident tag fees. We do support 100% tag fee increase on non-residents, even though we know that we have to sell those hunts and we have to sell those increases. At the same time, we're not coming here and asking for the state to help us sell our hunts. We're confident that we can continue to do business as we have before and generate more revenue for the state. The second is the aspect of federal overreach and oversight. I've had the good fortune of coming before this testimony, this committee, and talking about federal oversight and federal overreach and how it relates to Alaska's guide industry and the federal management authority. And I can say that we're asking to pay more money, we're asking to contribute more dollars to the Alaska's Department of Fish and Game to maintain our primacy of wildlife management in the state. If we do not have the money to do inventory counts, if we rely on the federal land managers to do those things, we basically allow our fate to be dictated by somebody else, the people that are willing to pay for it. We, as an industry, feel that it's our job and our obligation as sportsmen to come forward before this body and ask to pay more. In that regard, I'd like this body to recognize that we're working with a coalition of groups that includes resident interests. This is a goodwill effort by Alaska hunters and sportsmen, by industry. Quite frankly, everyone asks that industry come forward and support reasonable fees, reasonable tariffs on Alaska's resources that are commonly owned, and you have that before you now. The third is that the coalition, and this is important to us, is that some of the changes that came out of House Finance, there were some increases beyond the 100% level for the non-resident tag fees on black bears and brown bears. And, you know, these issues of fairness and good faith, when we come forward and discuss these and choose to work with the resident interests and knowing that our members are residents themselves, those things are important to us. And it's very symbolic about how the body and the state views our use in the industry that we bring here. And with that, I'll conclude that this is an effort to free Alaska's wildlife management from the vagaries of oil price and oil production. And we ask for your support, and we ask for your understanding of that good faith effort.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stacey. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Last person signed up here in the room to testify is Doug Larson. Mr. Larson. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Doug Larson. I'm testifying on my own today as no affiliate with any organization. I live in Juneau, and I've enjoyed the privilege of living in Alaska all my life and hunting and fishing throughout the state. I served as the director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation during 2007 to 2010, and as a result of that, I had an opportunity to understand the challenges that go on with budgets for the Division of Wildlife Conservation, and it's to some degree the Division of Sport Fish as well, just by association. I understand the importance of general funds and the graciousness that the legislature has had in the past to provide CIPs for things like intensive management and other wildlife-related programs, which I can elaborate just briefly on in a moment, which include endangered species listing preventions, research to do that, and also serving inventory work that you've heard from others on. I support the Sportsman Coalition's proposed rates, and I feel the amounts in the existing bill are insufficient to maintain those viable programs. So, as others have said, I would encourage this body to increase some rates, particularly on the resident side. I've heard that there may be concerns among legislators not to raise resident fees too much, and as a resident, I appreciate that. I appreciate legislators looking out for my interests, certainly. However, I think it's important to note that non-resident hunters make up less than 20% of the hunters in Alaska each year. They take relatively few game, but they contribute 75% of the funds that go into the Fish and Game Fund. Resident hunters make up about 80% of the hunters in Alaska each year, but contribute about 25% of the funds to the Fish and Game Fund. And we have a similar relationship on the sport fishing side as well. Now, this isn't so much, in my mind, a reflection of inappropriately high non-resident fees. In fact, if you look at our non-resident fees relative to other states, ours are lower. And I think that's why the coalition is supportive of having a 100% increase for non-residents. Rather, it's really a function of inappropriately low rates on the state residents. And that's why I support increasing the rates for residents. I retired last October, and my income is now less than it was while I was working. Nonetheless, like many other Alaskans, I'm willing and prepared to dig deeper in my own pocket to pay a higher amount to ensure that programs like surveying inventory, intensive management, protections against ESA listings, and access defense is viable. This isn't the first time that this issue's come up. In fact, when Matt Robus was director prior to my tenure, it was brought up as a subject. It came up during my tenure, and most recently while Doug Vincent Lang was director. However, up until now, we couldn't find agreement among user groups. At this point, there is strong, broad support for a higher resident and non-resident fee increase. This is huge. I mean, I think you've heard from others that have pointed out the broadness of the coalition that has come forward with this. I wanted to speak briefly to the IM surcharge. The term IM conjures up anxiousness in many people's minds. It just does. It's a reality. Mr. Somerville explained it's part of our laws. The Department of Fish and Game works to follow through on those laws. I'm not sure whether an IM surcharge is the correct terminology. Fact of the matter is, funds that would come in through something like a management pass or surcharge would be used not only for intensive management, which is, as Mr. Stevens said, not just predator control. It's to look at habitat to see whether predator control is even the appropriate measure to take. So that's I think, a huge thing that needs to be noted, is that those funds would go, all those funds that would come in, whatever you call them, would go into the Fish and Game Fund. They could be used for serving inventory, intensive management, and wildlife diversity. The state receives $2 to $3 million annually from federal state wildlife grants. This is separate from Pittman-Robertson funds, but like Pittman-Robertson, they need to be matched with state dollars. That's where this idea of a conservation pass comes in, because those funds could help match those dollars, which are used for a variety of things, including research to ensure that species that are not hunted, trapped, or fished are not listed as endangered. And we have many examples of where funds from those sources have been used and resulted in preemption of ESA listings. They include yellow-billed loons, black oyster catchers, bats, kitlets, merlets, and stellar sea lions. More recently, funds have been used to study Southeast Alaska's wolves to inform a petition that's currently out there to list the wolf as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. That research is costly. It requires detailed information in order to stand up to legal challenges. I don't need to tell you, listings of game or non-game species have huge implications for hunting, fishing, and trapping, as well as for mineral and oil exploration and extraction and timber harvesting, huge economic impacts. The last thing I'd like to say, Madam Chair, is I had the privilege of serving on the Governor's Wildlife Transition Team. That team had people from a broad array of backgrounds and interests, and frankly, there were people that didn't see eye to eye, and even people that I had worked with as director who I didn't see eye to eye with. However, there was consensus on a number of items, including the need to increase license fees and to do so sufficiently, the need to diversify revenue sources, and that's where this concept of a conservation pass is so important, because it would bring a much broader constituency to the table to help manage Alaska's wildlife. And there was also agreement among that transition team that we should expand and enhance intensive management, specifically expand intensive management aspects, not just predator control. So in other words, get more information about habitats, predator-prey dynamics and assessments. These are all part of the IM process. An IM surcharge that I mentioned and has been brought up would help with that specifically. Madam Chair, I really appreciate, and committee members, the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Larson. Representative Tallarico, would you like to come to the table with any closing remarks?
Madam Chair, thank you so much. I just appreciate the opportunity to have the presentation in front of the committee. And I have the groups have all approached me. We're still friends, although I don't agree with them at all. The only thing I want to say is I've gone throughout my district, and with resident license fees, the people that I represent are where they want to be in the current bill, so which is vitally important to me. But I really appreciate the opportunity to do this. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. I appreciate your courage in bringing this issue up. So thank you very much. So with that, we're going to set the bill aside. As I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, we will be having hearings on this bill over the interim. There is clearly a lot of interest and differing opinions, but nevertheless, something will need to be addressed here as state revenue decreases. We're going to take a brief at ease while the PowerPoint is set up, and then we're going to go on to the presentation by Analytica. We'll be at ease. We're back on the record, and I welcome Niku Sapos and Jenik Mayer, both with Analytica. They're here today to give us an AKLNG update, kind of end of the session update. Welcome, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. For the record, Jenik Mayer, partner at Analytica. As I've said before in introducing myself, this is now my fourth session being here at this table advising on oil and gas issues, in previous years oil and gas taxes, for the last 2 years, AKLNG and all of the issues around that. We are of course consultants to the legislature, engaged through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. My colleague Nikos will kick off this presentation.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Nikos Tsafos. I'm a partner at Analytica, and my background is really in natural gas consulting. We wanted to come here and give an update of where we think we are in terms of AKLNG as we finish this legislative session. And we wanted to offer an external audit, if you will. We've actually spent most of the session not in Juneau, and so we've been monitoring the events in Juneau, and so we wanted to sort of come and tell you where we think we stand at the end of this session. We wanted to start off with this slide, which is what we showed you last time we were here, in terms of the agenda. And I don't want to spend too much time because I think some of you have seen this slide more than is healthy. But you know, we're in the pre-FEED stage, trying to figure things out, and we have a very healthy agenda in terms of what really needs to get agreed upon over the next year and a half, in order to possibly come into a special session of the legislature to sort of set before this body a series of agreements in order to move the project forward. There was one thing on this list that was meant to happen this legislative session, that was property tax. The broad understanding was that, you know, maybe there would be a bill to authorize the administration to go negotiate a property tax agreement that included, you know, payment in lieu of taxes. That didn't quite happen, so that was a milestone that was sort of semi-missed. But obviously the bigger question, the sort of elephant or polar bear in the room, is the sort of Plan B that has been put forward by the governor. So we wanted to try to have a good sort of frank conversation about how we think, you know, that the introduction of that idea into the process has really affected the big picture, has affected AKLNG. And obviously, the way we see it, there's been sort of an introduction of a new idea into the process that has raised questions about alignment. It has raised questions about alignment between the state and the producers, and it has raised questions about alignment within the state, between the legislature and the administration. And we also have sort of announced a 45-day review process of AKLNG, and it's not quite clear how that affects this timetable. And so we wanted to sort of offer three broad takeaways in terms of this conversation. Again, we want to be first sort of very candid and try to provide our expert assessment of where we think where we think things stand right now. The first observation, again, in the spirit of frankness, is that, you know, at least from a distance and up close, it seems that the state is becoming a major sort of risk factor, or state commitment to the project, state alignment in this project is becoming a major risk factor for AKLNG, right? And so we'll talk about that. The second thing is that if you do end up having a process where you, as a state, try to pursue two projects at the same time, you're going to undermine both projects. You're not going to be able to get very far trying to do two projects at the same time. And lastly, the good news, so these two statements are not very good news. The good news is that we think that some of the underlying concerns that have led to the development of a Plan B can be fairly easily addressed in the context of AKLNG. Right? That there is really an easy way out, that the overarching concern, which we think is the state not really being held back by one of the producers, not wanting to move forward, that we think is the major concern. There are pretty straightforward contractual ways to get around that question, so we want to talk about that. So we want to talk about sort of where things stand, but also maybe an easy way out that could be much less disruptive, we think, to the AKLG process. Okay? That's what we want to do today.
Very good.
So our presentation is going to focus on really these two things. We want to talk about risk analysis, and we're going to talk about, is there another way? And we wanted to start off with slide three here. And we really wanted to sort of step back and say, you know, if your job is analyzing LNG markets or buying LNG or selling LNG or investing in LNG, what are the things that you look at? How do you think about projects? How do you think if you're a potential counterparty, if you're a buyer, a potential buyer, if you're a potential competitor, if you're a potential investor, if you are a potential financier of the AKLNG project or any project? What are the things that you think about? And we try to group it in these sort of five broad categories. And I don't want to go read every single line there. You can read that on your own. But broadly speaking, you care about five things. You ask yourself, will the gas supply be reliable? You know, is there gas there, and do I know that these guys can produce it, and can I be sure that this gas is going to show up when I need it to show up and things aren't going to happen to disrupt that? Are the sponsors credible? And what we mean by that is the people that are trying to sell me this gas, you know, do they know what they're doing? Have they done this before? Do they have the money? Do they have the organizational capability and expertise to pull this off? Is there stakeholder buy-in? Is the sovereign in which this project takes place supportive of this project? Are the local communities supportive of this project? Is there a broad process to reconcile differences? Is there an environmental impact statement process? Is there judicial review? Are there ways to sort of bring disparate groups into a system to try to adjudicate differences? Those are things that are really important. Does the ecosystem support development? Are there roads and bridges and railways and people in order to support the development of a project? In many places in the world, you kind of have to build everything from scratch because you don't always find oil and gas close to things. You find oil and gas wherever you find oil and gas. Thankfully, Alaska went through that process 40 years ago, and so you've sort of built some of that infrastructure, and so you're not starting from scratch. And then lastly, is the project commercially viable? You know, how much is this going to cost? And is that price tag worth the risk? And is that price tag attractive enough relative to other price tags? Right. So those are, broadly speaking, the five things that you really care about. So what we want to do, and I'm going to hand this over to Janik, is kind of walk you through an assessment of these five factors relative to where we were on January 1st with AKLNG, where we would have been looking at the sort of Plan B idea, and how things look when you put the two things together. Okay, so I'm going to hand this over to Janik now.
For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. So in looking at AKLNG, what we've shown here is how we think about AKLNG against these criteria, and in particular how we've thought about AKLNG throughout last year, you know, up until a month or so ago, the last time we were here. Looking at AKLNG purely standalone in the absence of any other questions around backup plans and other intentions, what it looks like viewed in isolation, in that sense. Viewed in isolation like that, we're very clear that we think this is a very strong project. You know, we look at, will the gas supply be reliable? Well, we have at Prudhoe Bay a very, you know, proven, well-known resource where the gas is not only currently being produced but has been produced and reinjected multiple times over the last several decades. At Point Thompson, we have a new resource, the one that's more technically complex, but one that is very well within the capability of the operator to produce. And all of those sort of things that we look at to say, will the gas supply be reliable, we look at Freke LNG and say, yes, we can give that a green light. And as you can see, we've sort of tried to sort of color code our thoughts on these with a simple green, yellow, red traffic light system to give an indication here. Other sponsors are credible. In this case, we have three major oil and gas companies, not just three of the largest and most experienced oil and gas companies around, but three of the largest and most experienced international LNG players around. It's in some ways unusual to have this much capability and expertise on one project in terms of LNG capability and what the different partners bring. Well capitalized, and more than that, I think what has truly surprised both of us, particularly sort of as we came to look at this in 2013 and last year, is just how committed these companies are to this project. You know, we've had a long history of lots of different ideas around how North Slope Gas would be commercialized, a long history of failed negotiations, sometimes with these three companies, lots of times when people weren't quite sure, are they really serious about doing this or not? And I think in looking at it this time, the thing that has really struck both of us is just how committed all three companies are to this, just how much they've committed in terms of the level of spending on the project year after year, in terms of how many people are involved, in terms of executive and management time, in terms of putting the very best people that they have on this. It's really struck us just how committed the partners are to this project.
So, Jinnick, a question. You know, we got a letter from the governor on April 10th, and one of his concerns expressed in the letter was, well, what if one of these companies pulls out? What will we do then? Is that something you're going to address later on? Is that something you can address now?
Madam Chair, we have a slide at the end that is specifically on that question, because we absolutely agree that we see that as central to the whole concern around a backup project. We think that is a crucial and very, very valid concern, and we also think that there are very established ways in the industry of dealing with this that are much more established than trying to create a separate project to do so. So we will definitely come to that.
Great, thank you.
As we go through the slide deck. On the question of stakeholder buy-in, you know, one of the other things that's been remarkable, particularly through last year, last legislative session, we talked a lot about alignment. But it really has been amazing when, for anyone familiar with the history of oil and gas development and the relationship between companies and the state in Alaska, it has for so long been one of combined interest, but too frequently distrust and an antagonistic relationship of negotiating against each other to try to get something done. And I think it really, really struck us last year how much that had begun to change, and with a structure in which the state was an equal co-partner, how much suddenly the state and the companies were seeing themselves as partners in a joint venture together and moving forward on finding win-win solutions, you know. Obviously, with the times there were going to be contentious negotiations and other things, but that everyone was trying to find ways in which everyone could win so that we could do this thing together, and we found that pretty remarkable. As Nico says, the ecosystem clearly supports development in a way it doesn't in many places in the world, whether that's established roads and facilities and infrastructure, whether that's a highly capable oil and gas workforce, a whole number of things that facilitate development from that perspective. And the major sort of yellow light, the major question mark about the project at this point is simply one of, you know, estimated cost and what that's going to end up being, where the oil price is eventually, how this competes with projects, whether that be from the lower 48 or elsewhere in the world on a cost basis, and whether this can make the cut on that front. So that's a yellow light for the project at this point, with a lot of green in all of the other areas. In talking about a plan B, we want to make a couple of things clear. First up, on the title of this slide. When we use the term standalone, that is in no way meant to be a reference to the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. We use the term standalone to say, if we were thinking about Plan B as a project or based on the few things that have been articulated about it and trying to sort of think those through and how those might shape. And we're thinking about this as though there were no AKLNG, as though it were just by itself as a lone project to commercialize North Slope gas. How would we think about this? So, you know, we tried to analyze what we think that plan might look like as best we can, given what's been articulated primarily from the governor and from other sources about what that might look like. And obviously there isn't very much detail there at the moment, so what we're presenting is our best assessment of what we think that might look like. And because there is inherently a lot of doubt and a lot of questions around what that might look like, we've tried to, wherever possible, give it the benefit of that doubt in terms of being generous in our assessment where we have questions. On the question of will the gas supply be reliable, that's a yellow, and the reason it's yellow I think is fairly obvious, which is that if it's not a project in which the three major resource holders and producers are involved, it's not clear where the gas comes from and where the title to that lies and how the gas is obtained. There are a number of ways that we can imagine that could happen. But the first thing that we think is really important to point out is that when we look at either these companies or any major oil and gas players around the world, it's very, very rare that these companies are involved in LNG projects and sell from the upstream perspective and sell their gas at or near the wellhead. These are companies that understand that to get the maximum value from that gas, they need to participate through a lot more of that value chain and generally do so. It's quite rare. In fact, I think we struggle to think of any examples of them selling gas at or near the wellhead in these sorts of projects. There is, of course, always a price at which these companies would be willing to do that. They are economically rational actors, and if one provides sufficient incentive for them to do that, one would imagine that they would be willing to engage in that transaction. It's much less clear that that's a transaction that anyone on the other side should be willing to engage in. There are obviously other questions that one could think about, you know, I know that it's frequently the whole question of leaseholders' obligations and sort of duty to produce, for instance, has been talked a lot about a number of times in this state, in this context. Maybe that's a viable strategy for requiring gas to be sold. Maybe that's not. We're not legal experts, and I don't know that we pretend to opine on that. But I think it's clear that even if one accepted completely that was absolutely eventually legally possible, that's a strategy for obtaining gas that is the eventual outcome of a decade of litigation. And so for any of these reasons, it seems the very, very best one could say about reliability of the gas supply is at most yellow on that front, compared to a project where the major resource holders are the driving factor behind the project. Are the sponsors credible? We've marked that as a red, and we want to explain why. We don't know very much about who the sponsors of this project would be. Clearly, the state of Alaska would be one. The state of Alaska certainly has substantial financial resources, for instance. In AKLNG, they're probably second in the consortium in terms of balance sheet strength. But the state of Alaska obviously does not have a lot of existing experience in bringing a project of this size, technical complexity, online. By and large, where we look at successful LNG projects around the world, they're done by established players with a lot of experience. In this case, the state of Alaska is not one of those. We hear other names mentioned in the context of such a plan. The name REI, for instance, has come up a number of times. It's an entity with which the administration has signed an MOU to look at some of these things. We can't honestly say very much, I think, about REI because, frankly, we haven't come across them in any other context other than this one. We're professional analysts that look at oil and gas companies for a living and have done for many years. Certainly opined at this table on numerous occasions about, you know, Conoco versus Exxon versus BP, different strategic signatures and intents and assets and portfolios. We do a lot of that for a living, and Nikos in particular, both of us have spent a lot of time with looking at almost all of the LNG players around the world and interacting with them all around the world. REI, as far as we can tell, is a small Japanese consortium of municipalities which would like to purchase LNG, but we're not aware of previous experience that they have in doing so, and certainly not in actually building a liquefaction project. It may be, it seems that the desired intent is to involve other entities at the buyer level in such a project, even, again, really wanting to be as generous as possible in thinking about what this could look like and who this might involve. You could bring in on board some of the most established utilities, for instance, the biggest buyers of LNG in Japan, in Korea, in China. Certainly these are companies that participate in liquefaction projects around the world, but they do so as small equity owners as part of an arrangement to buy LNG. These are not companies that have any substantial experience operating or driving, being the driving force behind a project of this magnitude. We think about any potential buyer we could think of in Korea, Japan, China, we can think of two examples of companies that have played a major role in LNG projects, and those are companies that are primarily upstream companies, not utilities.
Okay, thank you. Senator Walikowski, you had a question?
Thank you. Can you explain what that red, maybe you didn't, I missed it, but what does that red dot mean? Does that mean the state of Alaska is not a credible sponsor of a gas line?
The idea is that as we think about the range of possible participants, whether that, clearly including the state of Alaska, whether that includes a company like REI, whether that were to include some of the strongest utilities in Asia, a KOGAS, a TEPCO, whoever you might think of, that combination by itself in the world of what is required to get a major LNG project off the ground is not a credible combination of sponsors, absolutely.
And go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chair, if I could add just one more comment to Senator Wolkowski through the chair, because I've gotten in trouble before for calling people red on this Friday. And I've happened to do this with, and I won't say the name of the company, but this was one of the most capable upstream companies in the world. They just weren't LNG players. And what they discovered is they thought they were big shots, because they are in their world. And when they started going to Asia to sell LNG, people said, who the hell are you guys? Even though in their world, they were really credible. So this is really a very niche space that, people really know each other. It's a really tight world. Occasionally, people break into the world. But credibility here means something very specific, right? It means something very narrow, and it means about whether or not when you show up, you can say things and people look at you and feel like you can really pull off a project of this scale. So this is not, it's not necessarily to disparage the state of Alaska, because I think that this would apply to a lot of players that can be very established in other areas, but don't necessarily have that kind of credibility when it comes to an LNG project, and that they would have to prove that credibility either through bringing in partners, through bringing in a lot more additional resources, and so on and so forth.
Follow-up, Senator Walikowski.
So, by virtue of having the red dot here, is it safe to assume that your opinion is that the state of Alaska is incapable of building its own gas line?
Senator Wolkowski, through the chair, we would say that and I want to change the word gas line to an LNG project, so a GTP gas line and LNG project. I would say that a project that is primarily driven by the state of Alaska as a majority owner and sort of running the show, you would have a huge uphill battle convincing counterparties that this is something that they should sign up for. That would be my professional opinion, yes. It's not something that is insurmountable, but you would have to spend a lot of time convincing folks and bringing on teams of people and adding substantially to your capabilities to be able to make that case. It has happened. We have seen people that have never done LNG before do LNG, so I don't want to make this a world that if you haven't done it, you can never do it. But it's not an easy game. We've seen players spend 3-4 years just going around the world knocking on doors day in and day out before anyone starts really taking them seriously.
Proceed.
On the question of stakeholder buy-in, again, thinking about this in a sort of standalone world where there is no other competing project, this is the only way of commercializing North Slope reserves, then again, trying to be as generous as possible, we say that's a green, because clearly the state would be highly bought into that, the other partners would be highly bought into that, as long as one could assume that gas supply was a soluble problem. So we've given that a green. The ecosystem clearly is the same in both of these cases, so we've marked that a green. And in the same way as for AKLNG, we marked commercial viability a yellow because it's yet to be proven, again, to be generous, a yellow once again. Coming to the question of looking at these side by side, the basic point we want to make here is that when you place them side by side, they don't stay the same. Each one is negatively impacted. The risks to both are exacerbated by the existence of the other. And so we wanted to talk through, again, those five categories to think about why, in the way that we look at these things, we see that being the case. In terms of the question of will the gas supply be reliable, you know, this is the most fundamental question that any nation to LNG project needs to address in order to have the sort of first pass the first hurdle of credibility. For Plan B, that it's to us is a clear red as long as AKLNG exists and is progressing seriously, because we have one project in which the resource holders are active participants and try to push ahead, and another project that is trying to develop the same gas reserves at the same time that have already been committed to this other project. So it's very hard to see how you approach anyone, whether that be approaching Department of Energy for an export license, whether that be approaching financiers, whether that be approaching buyers, and say, well, we have this LNG project we're trying to develop, because the first question they come to you with is, okay, so do you have the gas? Very, very hard to see how that is overcome, and that's why we mark that as a red. But we also mark, where we previously marked this as a green for AKLNG, we mark it now as a yellow for AKLNG, because at the same time as the resource holders and sponsors are developing this, we have potentially a case where the state seems to be involved in another competing project that seems to be trying to market the same gas molecules, and ultimately the sovereign decides a lot. And so the question of, okay, these companies have the lease rights to this gas, they're trying to develop a project, but how certain are we that they will ultimately be able to do so and have the gas to deliver to market when the state seems to have another interest? So we mark that as a yellow in this circumstance when the two are being concurrently developed.
Thank you. Senator Welikowski, you had a question?
I did. Thank you. You said that this was sort of an external audit that you were preparing for us, and I appreciate that. But who did you talk to in preparation for this audit that you conducted?
Senator Welikowski, through the chair, we talked to the people we always talk to. We've talked to the legislature, we've talked to the administration about aspects of this. We didn't get anyone's approval for putting this together. We've spoken to the oil companies, we've spoken to people who are truly third parties. You know, we meet and engage with people who work in this space. And we've had people that ask us about Alaska and hear, read in the paper about Alaska, and so they ask us. We didn't do a dedicated survey, so we didn't just go out and ask people this last month, tell us what you're thinking. But we, as Janik said, you know, we've made a long living out of analyzing projects, and so we try to put that hat on in terms of trying to get a little bit of a distance. So we didn't do an external audit in the context of, you know, we didn't type up a survey and send it out to 500 people or 10 people or 20 people and ask them of their opinion. That's not what we mean by an external audit, and my apologies if that's in any way was construed to mean that. But it means that, you know, trying to tell you how the actions here sort of are seen from the perspective of, you know, I mean, we've been following Alaska for a lot longer than we've been working for Alaska. I mean, we've been monitoring Alaska gas line project. You know, the company that Janik and I work for, PFC Energy, did a study back in 2006 on the V line and whether to send gas to Chicago, right? So, I mean, we've been following Alaska gas developments for a long time.
I would add to that, if I could, and this basic mode of analysis, right, of thinking through what are the key enablers or things that hinder a project is something that both of us have done for many years. First of all, PFC Energy, now at Analytica. on pretty much every, well, every LNG project around the world. This is a core part of what it is that we do, and what we're trying to present to you in that sense is, as external industry analysts, the way that we have looked at every project in the world, applying that framework to this and explaining how we think about these things is primarily what we're trying to do here.
Senator Wallachowski, yeah, follow-up.
You're hired by the legislature, and I assume you keep detailed billing records. Do you have a list of the on your detailed billing records of who you talked to in preparation of this document that I could get?
Senator Wallachowski, through the chair, specifically in preparing this document, we talked with ourselves and debated passionately how we saw these things. There was no specific conversation we had with anyone that led to, other than a request for a presentation, that led to particular things in this document. I'm not quite sure what.
Follow up, Senator Wallachowski.
So in this external audit that you prepared, you're saying you didn't talk to anyone? Before you said you talked to the oil companies, did you talk to the producers, BP, Conoco, and Exxon, and TransCanada, who are involved in the AK LNG program? Did you talk to members of the Alaska Natural Gas Line Development Corporation? I'd like a list of who you talked to. Or are you saying there's nobody?
Senator Wolkowski, I apologize again. Maybe I was unclear, and I should be just more precise. This actually deck, these colors, this risk assessment, was really done between the two of us in our offices in Washington when news came out of Plan B, and we saw more and more talk about that. Now, what I was referring before is that, you know, Janik and I do more than just sit in our offices and talk to one another, right? That as we form our opinions, we talk to a lot of people. Now, we don't necessarily ask these people specific questions of, you know, do you think this is credible, or, you know, will a gas supply be reliable? But, yeah, we come in the building and we talk to legislators, we talk to oil companies, and we, you know, we live in a world where we interact with people who are monitoring projects, working on projects. But, you know, this specific assessment, I would say, was done pretty much in isolation, in the sense of not really serving anyone's opinion on this. But again, we don't just live as hermits trying to figure out what these things look like.
Senator Wallachowski.
Yeah. And I mean, here's the thing that I'm having a hard time understanding is that if basically what you're showing here is that if you have a concurrent development between AKLNG and Plan B, it appears by this that there's absolutely no chance that either one could go forward, which surprises me a little bit because based on what I've heard, BP and Conoco have not expressed that concern.
Senator Wallachowski, through the chair. I think we'd say two things to that. We wouldn't say that there is no chance at all of either going ahead, but we think that the risks to both projects are substantially exacerbated by them being pursued side by side. We can't claim to speak for the oil companies, obviously, nor would we ever want to. We work for the legislature. What we would say is, in terms of one of the reasons it's very important to us to be here to say some of these things is I think we would absolutely say, for instance, that, you know, the companies involved in this project have the state of Alaska as their co-venturer in this project and have to be very careful and very diplomatic about some of the things they say about what their co-venturer does. We're here purely as external observers of this industry who spend a lot of time watching these projects to try to deliver a message perhaps a little more bluntly, a little less diplomatically, in some ways because we think it's important that we do so, precisely because we know that some of the companies involved are going to be a little more measured about what they say because they have very important relationships that they need to maintain.
If I could, Madam Chair.
Follow up?
Did any of the producers tell you that they had concerns about what, about the governor's plans?
Senator Wilkowski, I don't want to go into details of exact conversations that we have with producers, but I would say, in general, in talking to industry, is there a tenor in those conversations of deep concern about where things are headed? that is perhaps not conveyed in public comments? Yes, I would say without a doubt.
All right, go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
Just the context of that, and I appreciate the questions. The difference between us and the partners we have with AKLNG is their board of directors get to meet in their offices without the cameras watching them. We're a board of directors that do everything out in the open, so it's no doubt that it would cause concern if everything that was done in the board of directors of Exxon as they made decisions on this, probably these discussions wouldn't happen at the same rate. So we're at a very different level of conversation. So I appreciate the questions because we have to do everything very, very openly.
Gentlemen, you also mentioned the Department of Energy and, you know, the question of where is the gas supply? You know, is the gas supply reliable? So we do have this other entity, the Port Authority, that's been out there. Does the Department of Energy authorize an export license to projects that don't have gas in hand? What do they take into account if they give an export license?
Madam Chair, for the record, Nico Safos. In general, the Department of Energy doesn't. And in fairness to the Department of Energy and to the Port Authority, it's not really a question that the Department of Energy has to consider because the vast majority of applications it gets are from projects in the lower 48. And their answer to the question, where is the gas coming from, is from around. Mm-hmm. There's gas. There are pipelines flying left and right. We'll find gas. And so they don't necessarily think about gas in the context of one project. They think about the aggregate gas supply. But when there isn't a readily available resource that you can just tap into, like the lower 48, as in the case of Alaska, they do look at the resource base and where you're going to get gas from. And you know, the Port Authority had made an application that was dismissed by the Department of Energy, and one of the reasons for dismissal was that. We did a sort of quick search, and as far as we could tell, and this may not be exhaustive, but as far as we could tell, that was really the only application that the DOE has dismissed over the last 4 or 5 years. And so it is definitely one of the things they look at, is if you want to export gas, it's a very natural first question to ask, you know, where is this gas?
Thank you. Senator Walikowski.
Thank you. How much are you paid by the Alaska legislature in the last year, and what is your hourly rate for each of you?
Senator Walikowski, I'm just trying to be accurate in answering this. The Legislative Budget and Audit Committee obviously employs us and can give you full details of our contract. Our current arrangement is a fixed retainer whereby we do 5 days of work every month, and for work over and above that we have a daily rate. I don't know that we necessarily want to go into the precise details of that right now, but I know that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee can make that available to you because that's on the public record.
So you don't know how much you got in the last year?
Specifically right now, no.
You don't know what your hourly rate is?
Senator Walikowski, it is in the public record. LBNA approved that contract. I know that that can be supplied to you. Okay. I believe it's on the LBNA website, in fact.
Okay.
It was publicly vetted. Thank you, gentlemen. I'll let you proceed.
So on the question of sponsor credibility, we said before, big green light for AKLNG in isolation because we have three of the world's biggest LNG companies involved. Now, you know, we can debate red versus yellow. There's no sort of absolute perfect science to some of these things. But the basic idea we wanted to convey here is that while Plan B exists, A, there is a fundamental question from outside counterparties, whether those be buyers, investors, analysts, etc., as to the commitment of the state of Alaska to this project. And when that becomes a fundamental question, there's the concurrent concomitant question of how long do these three major companies remain as committed as they are? How long is the current level of spending maintained? And that for us is certainly a substantial downgrade from a green, whether that's a yellow or a red. You know, here we've marked it as a red here because that's what we ultimately believe. Different people could have differences of opinions, but the fundamental point we want to get across here is that sponsor credibility is substantially diminished by having one of the key sponsors, the state of Alaska, no longer clearly dedicated to this one project, and by the ever-increasing likelihood that others will slow their pace of spending and investment if their co-venturer is not clearly completely dedicated to the project. Similarly, on stakeholder buy-in, once again, we have the problem of alignment between the state of Alaska and the companies involved, as well as alignment between the branches of the state itself, the executive and the legislature. These are all things that suddenly mark the project as source for concern for all of those counterparties watching. Finally, the ecosystem remains one that is highly conducive to development, but ultimately we mark in both cases commercial viability is red, because suddenly when we look at the timeline of stage of development, milestones that are going to be reached, it becomes very, very difficult to see how these two things can be developed concurrently. And that specific point is one that Nikos is going to talk to on the next slide, so I'll hand over to him if I may.
Thank you, Janik. For the record, Nikos Savas and Alika, we only have two slides, so hopefully we'll be able to wrap up. I know that punctuality matters. And so I wanted to talk about this slide and try to put in sort of the terms that I think people will understand also at home. And I'll have an analogy, if you'll permit me, Madam Chair. I'll only take a couple of minutes. But, I mean, imagine if I showed up to set up a restaurant in Anchorage, and it's going to be Greek. It's going to be good. And I find Aki as my partner. And Aki and I say, oh, you know what, let's do a restaurant together. And Aki says, that's great. Nikos, you know, why don't you go get started? So I go off and go apply for a liquor license, go try to track down a chef and find an interior designer, start showing up at the bank. And then a month later, I figure out that Aki is actually developing another Greek restaurant, not in Juneau or Fairbanks, actually the same spot that I'm developing it, and talking to the same chef that I'm talking to, and talking to the same bank that I'm talking to. And I feel like if that were to happen to any of us, the first question would be like, hold on there. You know, why am I out there killing myself trying to make this happen, and you seem to be sort of trying to do a competing project behind my back, or with not me in it? And that's sort of more or less the context in which I think of where this may head, which is that, you know, the AKLNG partners that you have will see this as a huge risk, that, you know, they're trying to put out all this money, trying to resolve all these technical risks and go through environmental permitting and export licenses and, you know, securing suppliers. And they have a risk that somehow they may get edged out at some point. And so that, we think, is really what the major risk the project does. And we don't want to go through all the details of this. You can read it. But, you know, there's some really practical things. When you show up in Japan and try to sell gas, you know, what gas are you selling? From which project are you selling? Are you selling from AKLNG? Or are you selling from Plan B? You know, buyers would like to know, and so on and so forth. So let me, being mindful of the time, let me just go to the last slide, which
Nikos,
is...
just wanted to mention that Senate Wills Chair Huggins has joined us. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Nikos Tsafos. So this is the last slide I have. And so I wanted to step back a little bit, because I know we've delivered sort of a fairly blunt and candid presentation that sort of tries to look at this. There's good news here at the end, and this is what we wanted to end up on, good news, which is that when we read, you know, the governor's statements, when we read the letters that the governor writes, when we read his op-eds, when you listen to him talk, you know, he's got one thing I fairly clearly right, which is that one of the major risks to this project is that you get a year from now at the table and you say, Company A, yay. Company B, yay. Company C, yay. Company D? No. And that's a major risk. And the good thing is that this is not something that is unprecedented, right? And so really what the question really is, you know, if the LNG project gets stalled, the question to ask is, well, why did it get stalled? You know, if this project, when you do the math, really costs $65 or $70 or $75 billion and oil prices are at 50, you know, it really doesn't matter who the partners are. This is just not going to be a project that's going to work, right? And so you can move partners around, you can twist things left and right, but this is going to be something that doesn't work. On the other hand, if this is a project that, you know, it's good, it's just that one or two of the partners isn't quite there yet, that's something that happens quite often. And really there are three ways to deal with that. That's what the right side of this is. One is you try to rework things. You try to change the route, or you try to convince the partner that's kind of holding back. Another option is you just wait. You say, look, this partner is not ready. We're just going to have to wait. But usually, and usually the optimal way, is you try to find a way to buy them out and try to say, look, we all want to move forward. You don't. Let's try to find a good price, compensate you for what you've put in so far, and you'll be on your way. This happened in Alaska, in Angola, you know, where actually your partner, ExxonMobil, was there, and they weren't quite committed to the Angola LNG project, and so they left, a new partner came in, and that sort of made things move forward. It's happened in Sabine Pass, where the sort of first set of partners, the first set of buyers, you know, they weren't quite there to move the project forward, so they went and found new buyers for the gas. You know, this is not something that is unprecedented, and it's a pretty typical part of, you know, joint venture agreements to say, look, if we have a certain amount of consensus and support for this project and someone is sort of being held, holding the thing back, let's try to find a way to bring in new partners, to maybe buy them out and then try to sell that share. And in fact, you have precedent even in Alaska with a Point Thompson settlement where Chevron wasn't quite excited about moving on. So instead of just stalling the whole thing or creating a new project, you just, you know, took off that share from their hands, right? So we think that, you know, if we read through the lines and we really get to the core of the concern, this is a good concern. It's a concern of not being held back because of one partner. You know, everything moves at the weakest link, right? This is a good concern. But there's a very simple way to resolve that, which is that you find a way to take out the weak link. You don't just recreate a new project. And so that's the sort of semi-upbeat message that I want to leave you with, because I think there is a real easy way to make sure that the agreements that the state signs include strong provisions for the state to be able to step in and either take the share itself or find buyers for the share or co-buy the share with some of the partners in order to make sure that if enough people around the table want to move forward, you can still move forward. And so with that, that concludes our presentation.
Nikos, a question. Another issue that the governor has expressed significant concern about, and it's in the April 10th letter, is that the AKLNG project is working backwards because the markets haven't been involved. Could you comment on that?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. For the record, Nikos Tsafos. That's not something I would agree with the governor. If you look at LNG projects, the vast majority of them really start from the resource holders. In fact, I can only think of a handful of projects. I'm just kind of doing the mental math, maybe two or three, that really the market has been a driving force of developing the project. Even if you look at the Lower 48, I mean, the Lower 48 started, you know, Cheniere Energy, which is developing the earliest of the LNG projects. I mean, they went out trying to convince the market for about 2-3 years before they were able to really tie anyone down. So even in a big place where everyone can just go and buy gas, it was still coming from the supplier side, people that were trying to offer gas. And most LNG projects, that's really how they start. I wouldn't necessarily agree with the statement that LNG projects start with the market. LNG projects start from the resource base, and then you
try to, as quickly as possible, find out if there is a market, but you really start from the resource.
To add to that, Madam Chair, if I could, all of that said, of course, engaging the market is critically important, right? And that's why the various AKLNG partners last year were making trips to Asia to meet with prospective buyers, including, you know, the former Commissioner of Natural Resources, why there is an expert, former Chevron LNG marketer, as part of the team at Department of Revenue. And there's no question that there has to be that momentum in terms of both the project overall for the individual partners, including the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska, under this current plan, all going well, would have a substantial amount of LNG to sell, and it absolutely needs to be deeply involved in talking to prospective buyers and marketing that LNG. But that comes from having, first of all, supply to market.
I would think also something, cost would have to enter into the picture, right? If you're approaching buyers, you have to have enough development of your idea to have some concept of what it's going to cost. Yes? No?
Madam Chair, absolutely. I mean, you know, at this stage, really, talking to the market, you know, if you went out and as my colleague Janik said, you know, your commissioner of former Commissioner of Natural Resources went to Asia, and at this point going to the market, what you're going to hear is, we think Alaska is great, this sounds like fun, and you guys keep us in the loop. And when you have, you know, real information, we'd like to talk. I mean, that's precisely what you're going to get, because you have no idea what you would like to sell your gas for, because you don't know how much this project is going to cost. So you don't know if you need to sell it for $8 or $10 or $12, so you can't really start talking about the details that really matter. And I think for the most part, at this stage of development, if you go to the market is going to tell you, sounds great, keep us posted, keep visiting us, and when you have more details, let's sit down and talk. That's pretty much what you'll get. And you may sign an MOU that says that we're interested in talking and keep in touch, but you can't really get very far because you're not ready to talk specifics and they're not really ready to do anything unless you start talking specifics.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Senator Costello.
Thank you. Just back to the questions that you ask in this presentation, are these essential questions is what I call them. Are these questions you ask of any project or were they specifically asked in relation to the question of AKLNG versus the ASAP project concurrently?
Senator Costello, to the chair, for the record, Nico Safos. These are generic questions. As you can see, I mean, we talk about visa restrictions right here. So it's not, we weren't really thinking just about Alaska LNG. This is a framework that, as Janik said, it's a process that we try to take a very structured approach to thinking about development of mega projects. So this really speaks to that. You'll see quite a few things that really don't apply in the context of Alaska. But again, we're just trying to speak more generically about what people look at.
Follow up? Further questions? Yes, Senator Walikowski.
What percentage of your income is derived from your work with the state of Alaska?
Senator Walikowski, we have a number of clients around the world, including a number that we worked with extensively in Europe last year. I can't give you a precise figure.
Follow up?
Yeah, there are requirements to file financial disclosure forms, and have you filed those with the state of Alaska?
I have not filed a financial disclosure form with the state of Alaska. I'm not aware of any to do so. I'm not aware of any particular interest that I have that would require disclosure, but I'm not sure what the reference relates to.
There's requirements that consultants of the state require financial disclosure forms. There's actually a bill to change that. But that's the reason I ask questions, because you're not listed anywhere in the financial disclosure forms. Does the state of Alaska make up a large percentage of your income? That's something I could find out had you complied with the law and filed those papers, but you haven't done that.
Senator Walikowski, through the chair, as you know, we've been doing this work for many years in many different incarnations. The state of Alaska has, in previous times, been a major client, but by no means a very significant one in the times that we were doing this through PFC Energy. We have a number of other clients now. The state of Alaska is certainly our largest client, definitely. And that, I think, comes from, I hope, many years of a relationship, trusting working relationship that we would like to continue. I don't know what more I can say than that.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here today. I appreciate your presentation. I want to thank the committee. This will be our last meeting of this legislative session. So thank you to Senator Costello, who has been the vice chair, and all the committee members who have faithfully attended. Thank you very much to Anne and the LIO audio staff. We've had various folks working with us, but I appreciate your service to us. So unless there's some kind of unforeseen circumstances, this will be our last meeting of the session. So at this time, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect that the time is 5:16 p.m. Thank you.